Blog Talk Radio.
General Quarters, Security Condition 3.
HQ, Security 3, sir. General Quarters 3, intruder alert. GQ 3, intruder alert.
So don't tell me you can't get a good help these days. That's the best doorman I've ever hired. Hi, welcome once again to Madam Perry Salon, the podcast with more celebrities than the inauguration. I am your host and cruise director, Madam Perry, but you can call me Jennifer Perry or Jen because I'm just happy to have you here. Let me start by thanking you once again for all the rise in subscribers. My listeners' stats have spiked. To the people that have gone to Apple iTunes for the Madam Perry Salon page or to Stitcher or anywhere and put a review of the show, thank you very much. And if you're new here listening live on Blog Talk Radio tonight, May 1st, you can click that little pink button that says follow. I'd appreciate that. Or just follow wherever you follow and listen to your podcast. And I appreciate a review. And so last weekend, you know, a while back we had bass player for Joan Jett, Celine Dion, Blue Oyster Cult, and of course Utopia, Todd Rundgren, and also Paul Myers. And Paul Myers was on about a month ago, and he wrote a book called A Wizard of True Story. And because he hung with the guys, got the story of all the produced during the years, and then stories about, you know, things that happen around the studio and so forth, or band life. And anyway, so last Todd Rundgren is on tour. It's like the part of the original Utopia. Willie Wilcox on drums, Kazem Sultan on bass, new guy Gil Asayas, I think he's a Swedish guy, on keyboards, and Todd Rundgren. They were in Atlanta last weekend. It's a dynamite show. Don't miss it if you get to see it. Also, last Huffman on. Now, Joey Huffman's a keyboard player, and he's a side man for everybody. He started off, he said, when he ran away from home at 15, take the road with Wild G. And he plays with, he was on Miranda Lambert's album. He's toured with her. He's Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, Izzy Stradlin, who's toured with Lou Reed. And he's getting ready to go back out on the road again with Hank Williams Jr. And so what he suggested to me, because we got so many listeners on the show, he asked me what I thought about him doing some little shows from the road. Like maybe he'll call into the show once a week or so and tell us what's going on with Hank and the band and tell some stories and tell the band stories du jour or of the week. And that will be fun. So anyway, but tonight, oh, listen, guys, thanks to you listening, subscribing, and following me and supporting me, you help me continue to get the best and most fantastic guest ever. Yes, I'm talking about you, Mimi and Dana, and I'm talking about you, Vinny, and you, Crystal, and you, James Breen, and everybody else that listens, and David Hurley, everybody else that listens and sends me messages. You all make it happen. If tonight's guest, he's an award-winning author, he's an audio dramatist and podcaster. He's a podcaster responsible for an audio horror series. I love radio plays and radio serials. I listen to like the old film noir, like Johnny Dollar and stuff like that, X-1 and all those things. But he's got one, the horror series HG World, and also the pulp superhero radio serial Hidden Harbor Mysteries. And he's got very highly acclaimed books, a short story collection, Seven Till Sunrise, Gamer Geek Satire, Rise of the Monkey Lord, And oh gosh, he's everywhere. But and I'll let him tell you all that. But there's a particular book of his, and I'm trying to figure out exactly how to go on describe this. It seems that you know, I had a guy, a friend of mine on, Kevin Guilfoyle, who wrote a book called Cast of Shadows that was about a crime being solved by this police officer or investigator going into a virtual world to meet with people and solve this crime. It was a crime where a doctor had substituted the DNA of the person he thought was the murderer of his daughter into a patient, thinking, well, when this kid grows up, I'll know what the murderer looks like and I can go after him. And so very creepy book, Cast of Shadows. And so they went to Second Life. But, you know, it seems like with the modern world, it seems to be people are kind of challenging rejecting the challenges of the real world for an idealized digital utopia online. Well, you can kind of see why. But now virtual reality is expanding the allure of such an escape, and it renders such rich experiences that strive to realize the futuristic holodeck of Star Trek, if you will, while at the same time, online societies have begun to create their own organizations around political or social ideals, inspiring loyalty among total strangers and inciting acts of both great generosity and even, on the other end of the spectrum, terror. So isn't that hard to believe that secret societies dealing with cult behavior and human trafficking could come of our need to escape the real world and find something simple and pure and more inclusive? Well, my guest's book has a book called The Resurrection Pact, very popular. I haven't finished reading it, so I don't want anybody to spoil the ending for me. But it's a novel dealing with such a society and how far a group will go in a virtual life to conceal a crime committed in the real one. And how does this book parallel with recent arrests and indictments of members of the New York cult Nexium, and which, if you've been following this, there was even a 2020 feature on it last weekend. It's a cult that promoted power through obedience to allegedly peddle sex slaves across the country. So I'm just going to go ahead. I got to bring this man in. He is fascinating. And so I just want you to welcome. It's not his first time in Madame Perry's salon. I hope it won't be his last. So welcome, author, creator, podcaster. I call him just a powerhouse of entertainment, Jay Smith. Jay, welcome back to Madame Perry's salon.
Hey, Madame Perry, how are you? Thanks for having me.
I am delighted to have you back. As it turns out, as we begin hearing about, now for many of us listening, and I hope you don't mind me leading with this, but for many of us listening to us, some of us didn't know about this Nexium group until we heard about Allison Mack being arrested. And yet, on the other hand, I didn't even know who Allison Mack was until I heard that, because I don't watch a lot of television. So I thought, okay, I learned a couple of new things.
Sure.
But as I understand, now you do a little bit of investigating and exploration on online societies and groups, and one thing I would have never thought of, the influence of the gaming in the world, mm-hmm. and how people who escape the real world for the virtual. I guess I should have, you know, like my friend Travis Sivert that was in here. But this funny thing about this, though, and I heard this from somebody else before I heard it from you, the whole story of this Nexium group seems to have an eerie parallel to your novel, The Resurrection Pact.
Yeah, I saw some of these things while I was doing some research on the book and concepts in the book. The concept of Nexium kept coming up, but I kind of dismissed it because it was labeled as a kind of a marketing organization. And, you know, in my research, I come across a lot of marketing and branding there's very similar traits in how thoughts are guided and manipulated in certain ways to inspire brand loyalty or company loyalty. So I didn't think about it in terms of cult behavior, but I did see that mm-hmm. people would ping on similar ideas. When I first heard about Allie Mack, and I'm a nerd, so I immediately know she's probably mm-hmm. from Smallville. And to hear that sweet character on TV was allegedly trafficking human beings. I'm like, wait, well, what, how did this happen? So I looked into it, and then the more I learned about Keith Raniere, the more I was startled by the parallel between what he does and the antagonist of the Resurrection Pact, and how he takes what we want most, what we don't even know we need, and exploits that in a way to create a society that is really about him, but is on the surface about finding that missing aspect of yourself and making yourself better, the ultimate self-help guru, if you will. And so as I started watching these YouTube videos about his affirmations and all of the his mannerisms and his tone of voice, his conversations with Allison Mack are on YouTube, and it's almost like a late night infomercial. There's really nothing about it that's he's very soft-spoken, and he uses soft words, and he uses turns of phrases that don't really mean anything, but they sound good. And I thought, wow, that's kind of how Alan Horace works in my book, and the relationship. Basically, he is able to manipulate women into becoming loyal to him, granting him sexual favors, doing menial labor for him. It's an astonishing tale. And I have to say that all of these allegations are allegations. They have not been proven. But just that the trail is very similar in many respects.
Man. So now, when was the Resurrection Pact published?
It came out about a year ago.
Uh-huh. So
and
when you began
none
following...
of that is...
Oh.
None of those direct connections had been made when it came out.
So when you started seeing this, you know, seeing the parallels, did you see it first, or did someone else mention it to you? And
I think the parallels came out as I was doing research for the sequel, and then seeing the news story, and then thinking, and then starting to look deeper into this particular situation and realizing the parallels.
Wow. I've got to ask you the same way I ask you, if you heard me talking about Kevin Guilfoyle in his book, Cast of Shadows, and then when he saw the difference, the parallel between that and Second Life, and this, his book came out, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago. I got to ask, I know it's like a corny, obvious question, but how did you feel? What was your reaction?
To Nexium? Or...
No, to see how was your reaction that there was a parallel between that character in your book and Keith Raniere?
It was creepy, but not surprising, because a lot of people that I've interviewed, I interviewed a number of people in Second Life and on other virtual platforms. I talked to people in people who were involved in BDSM activities and in similar groups where there's a very secret inner structure about and an organization that has strict rules and a rank and file system. And it does not surprise me, because what he's doing, very similar, but far more malevolent, allegedly, than any typical organization has. I mean, you can break his organization down and see elements of it in any group, whether formal or informal. Mm-hmm. I used to work for Target Corporation, and Target, it has its own language. You don't refer to customers as customers, they're guests. You don't have managers, you have team leads, and it's all about creating a culture that is unique to that group of people. The colors, the language is all there. And that's true of sports people or HR professionals, that they come together. And if I come home from work, for example, my main job is in human resources, I can start talking to my wife, and I will realize, like, 2 minutes in, I've used 7 or 8 terms that she has no idea what I'm talking about. But if I'm in a group of HR professionals, we all know what we're talking about. It's all shorthand. But if you put layer upon on that and you impose a motive, that's when it starts to get sinister. All of this is about directing your thoughts toward a common goal. And what I've found is that you can have a positive goal. You can be a sports fan, and the collective experience is very positive. You go to church, and a lot of that energy is directed outward to the community. You get into a cult, and all of that energy is there's a an an updraft of all that energy to one singularity, and that's the leader. And that doesn't surprise me because that's happened throughout history. So when I heard about this, I'm like, well, Keith is just the latest in a series of many people who include Charles Manson and the Heaven's Gate cult, Jim Jones, all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. Listen, but let me stop and say, if you're listening to us live right now and we want to call in and talk with Jay Smith, the number is 626-716-9922. That's 646-716-9922. Blog Talk Radio assures me it's a toll-free call within the continental U.S., and we do have someone on the line. Welcome. Let me see. Let me bring them in. Part that beaded curtain, if you would, please, Jay, and let this person in. Welcome to Madame Perry Salon. I'm here with Jay Smith. How do you do?
Doing very well. Thank you. Yourself?
I'm doing glad. I'm great. I'm so glad to have a – we know that before. You've been in here before. Find your cushion. You got your own seat in here, don't you?
Well, thank you. Don't go anywhere this time.
Okay.
William R. Hurt.
That's okay. I always bring the machinery out when the horror writers are here, like Jasper Barg. So nothing's going to snap down and trap you. Don't worry. I promise.
Okay, that's great, Jay. I'm glad to hear you're out. Selling more of the Resurrection Pact. It really is, for anybody who hasn't read it. It really is a masterpiece.
Oh, thank you. I did not pay him to say that.
Thank you. And will you tell us who you are for the audience that doesn't know you?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is William R. Herr, and I am a sad complimentary second to Jay Smith's amazing intelligence.
Will Herr is an excellent fantasy author. He and I have had many, many years of contentious conversations on many subjects. He's a long-term friend of mine. But I'll accept it.
Well,
I'll
know that you were a lively addition last time, Will.
Well, thank you very much.
So we're happy to have you back. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking that you're going to come in, you're going to sit down, and all of a sudden it's going to be. But I promise you that won't really happen, okay?
Okay, no, that's perfectly fine. I was just joking with you, Madam Perry. I have no desire to take over a talk show. I did it long enough when I was in my youth on AM radio, and I don't want to go there again. My hat's off to you to be able to do this.
So tell me, since you were probably one of the first people, Will, to read the Resurrection Pact, I would imagine.
I would say that would be accurate.
Would you say, and is it also true, remember, you're under oath, did you start noticing that there was a similarity between things in the book, character in the book, and in the Nexium?
Well, that's why I call it a masterpiece, because if you really want to go back to the origins of the online, if you want to go back to the origins of online reality, massively multiplayer games, you have to start with something called a MUD, which was a text-based multi-user dungeon or multi-user domain, all of which looked exactly the same. And people would dive onto them and basically play through the exact same game over and over and over again with different people just for the social experience. It was a way for individuals who were otherwise closeted to really get interaction in a fantasy setting, and they could be and do anything they want without repercussion. much like the Resurrection Pact. I don't think that I'm giving anything away there, Jay, am I?
No.
Okay. That transitioned. I played a lot of MUDs back when they were in their infancy, and then that transitioned to through AOL and finally out of AOL to a game called Meridian 59, which was the first truly 3D online role-playing game, massively multiplayer game. I think they're the ones who coined the phrase. And that generated just this mass of individuals who were getting married online, who were having affairs online, who were doing everything in their life they ever wanted to do, but they couldn't because they had shame. They were doing it online. Doing it relatively anonymously. And my wife and I, we got embroiled in that society, that area of society, the subset, if you will. And, it was really an eye-opening experience. And of course, after that, you had things like EverQuest and now World of Warcraft, and there are a plethora of others that you can dive into, including, Second Life. I believe, your book is based on Second Life. Is that correct, Chet?
Well, it's a hybrid of Second Life and Warcraft, where there's a heavy fantasy theme, but it's all free play, and people can build their own kingdom so long as it's quote-unquote zoned to be in the theme of Alan Horace's string of fantasy novels. So
right.
You can go in there, but you can build your own estate or farm, but you could also go on quests like Warcraft.
Right. And the depth of the Resurrection Pact isn't so much in its similarity, its eerie similarity to current events, which really isn't all that eerie when you consider the fact that, I mean, this is what happens. I mean, the physical side of things, the human trafficking side of things, not so much. But this is the mindset of the individuals, many of the individuals. I don't want to pigeonhole an entire subset of the country or several countries. But this is what happens when you take a realm where anything is possible, where there is near unlimited, ability, and yet no repercussion. I mean, it's freedom without repercussions. So why not do absolutely anything that you want to? And if you can get away with trafficking it into the here and now, why not do it? And that was what I found to be most brilliant about it. I think I said so on my review, didn't I, Jeff?
I think so. And that's the lure of cults is when somebody gives you something that is missing from your life that fulfills you, it breeds loyalty. And if you're in a group of passionate people and your focus is on making each other whole, it's the experience that, like in Nexium, some of the people involved reported saying they gave up on their family lives in order to go to these week-long celebrations of their leader's birthday. Not because the leader was there to bask in his glow, but because of all of these really amazing people who made their life complete. And in online, yeah, similar, my interviews with people online, consistently, their views were, you know, I come here because I get here what I can't get out there. In some cases, they're physically or mentally disabled. In other cases, they're in a bad marriage. They work 18 hours a day. They have no social life. Something about that world draws them in. And I'm not saying that Second Life is a cult, but if you introduce an element at the core of that world, say Neil Gaiman, who is a fantastic grandmaster fantasy author. He's also an electric speaker. He's got a wonderful personality. I have heard women swoon when he talks. Imagine if Neil turned his powers for evil and his values started to attract people to do his bidding. And that's where the cult element begins, because then you're doing things for Neil. And you're not doing them directly for Neil, but you're doing them for the society that gives you back energy because you've done something for Neil. And then that way, that's Alan Horace in the center of the book. So you've got a lot of people who are going to this virtual world who are finding not only freedom to do something, but they're getting back the energy from the creator of that world. And they feel that this is not God, but this is somebody who has made them whole. Yeah, that's the reaction I often get when I lecture on this.
No, because, you know, when I watched the 2020 this last weekend, and the woman was showing her that had been in this for so long, so many years, and what is the other, Rainier has to be referred to as Vanguard Salzman. I forget her first name. She's the prefect.
Yeah.
But when this woman was in the cult, she She's talking about having a meeting where it's supposed to be just all the women together and take off their little clothes. And she thinks it's just some kind of, I guess, just a girl thing, you know, getting naked. And then they start to brand them, and they held them down. And the interviewer said, okay, well, you saw what was going on. What kept you from just running out the door even though you were naked? I don't know.
Well, in the moment, they feel that that is a tribute. And, you know, I know enough frat guys to know that you'll do something incredibly stupid just to prove that you're part of that collective. And, you know, they've snapped out of it, and they realize this was, you know, self-mutilation, or this was mutilation, and this was a violation of in the most intimate sense. But also, these women freely offered up what they call collateral to their leaders, like incriminating photographs of themselves, nude photos of themselves, information, secrets that you know, they were presenting to say, here's why you should trust me. I'm trusting you with these intimate secrets. And they were really being used, if you left, that you ran the risk of having that information shared. But in the moment, it's to them, it's that they have been conditioned to say, here, take this of me. I'm giving this to you out of trust. And it's because they have been wrapped in this positive experience that they don't realize they're being pulled into something like Nexium or DOS, I guess.
When you were talking about, like people get involved looking for something they can't find, you know, things happen. You get busy, you work, and maybe if people are working several hours, working different shifts, taking the kids, you kind of have a disconnect, and here's a place you go, and you start connecting with folks online. But you think it also adds a little extra glamour, and you might have answered this when you mentioned gaming, but then also when there's a celebrity involved, you know, we can't get enough celebrities. God knows, I wish that I had an app that kept the word Kardashian out of everything on my that I look at. But for other people, there are people who, you know, live their lives wanting to dress like these people and do what they say, do and talk what they talk. So do you think then maybe having a celebrity just kind of amped up their membership or their allure?
I think in this case, and I drew the parallel of Neil Gaiman, he would be more of a Kardashian kind of parallel because it's a cult of personality. Neil is brilliant, and I don't want to compare him in any way to the Kardashians, except in the fact that he is not globally known, but he's known well enough that you generate esteem. In the case of a cult leader, they don't want to be globally known unless you're like, you're one of the elites. It's enough that a group of intelligent and creative people realize that they've stumbled onto something brilliant, and that they're just enough of them to be part of the secret group. And they don't want him to, in a way, they don't want him to share his gospel with the world. They want to be part of something special. So I think to a degree of celebrity is there, but after a certain point, it becomes too transparent. If you had the Kardashians start a cult, there's just so much exposure on them that there's no way that they could get beyond the kind of the zombie stare of their adoring fans. And fandom, as obsessive as it can be, is not a cult. A cult requires that you are detached from the people who your support system and the people who love you, and that you are in a position where you are emotionally immersed in that group and that society and that group think. Whereas the Kardashians, they thrive only in sunlight. They do not exist when the camera's not on them. So I don't know. I think to a certain point, yes, you're right. But, you know, after a certain point, you get diminishing returns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. But then Buddy Ebsen introduced Kevin to the world in his original Ponzi scheme. So perhaps I'm being too short-sighted.
Really?
Yeah. If you watch the 2020 special, part two introduces his first. It was an idea of people buying appliances collectively and for discount prices. And he was put out of business by a bunch of attorneys general. But his infomercial was introduced by Buddy Ebsen, who's, oh, you're brilliant.
Oh.
You're a genius. And, so, yeah, thanks, Buddy. Thanks for bringing
well,
him to the world.
Well, to be fair, I mean, you can pay an actor to say absolutely anything, and they can always say, I didn't actually believe that it was in the script.
I agree with you, Will. I was being sarcastic.
Yeah. But,
So, there's just so many places. I hardly know where to go next. About the common traits in reporting about NXIVM and the world of, help me get, if I don't want to pronounce this incorrectly, Eternus.
Mm-hmm. Eternus, yep.
Okay. Because I think, as I understand, one of the major themes of the Resurrection Pact, and I want to say that a lot, the Resurrection Pact. I want to get the name of your book out more. The Resurrection Pact is getting lost in a fictional story about how technology evolves. From, I don't know, somehow we went from checkers and Parcheesi up to World of Warcraft. I don't know. But, toward a fully immersive experience. So tell me, because I've got a friend who does all these games. He keeps asking, well, have you ever played so-and-so? I'll say, no. He never asked me if I've ever done any games because I haven't. And he just says, well, have you ever played so-and-so? No, I haven't. Oh, so what does fully immersive mean? And how does that tie into the idea, say, of cults? And I suppose from there, loss of...
I'm pulling up a reference. Okay,
you
there
too.
It is.
I mean...
I just want to make sure I got the name right, but... I read a book back in the 90s by an MIT scientist, Janet Murray, called Hamlet on the Holodeck. And of all places, I found it in a bargain bin. I found it as a remainder. Somebody hadn't picked it up, and I picked it up. I devoured it. And the idea was that narrative storytelling has progressed since the Stone Age, that linear storytelling is a passive activity. You sit down, you read the book from beginning to end, you watch the movie from beginning to end. And games have an abstract story woven into them. So these are two pastimes that have worked parallel for so many centuries but are now colliding because as you look at new video games, story is more and more part of the experience to a point where, you know, I had the Atari 2600 growing up. So these big pixel monsters became characters, and we allowed ourselves the illusion that these blocks on our screen were part of a story, and we were controlling that story. Fast forward to today, you have Second Life and Warcraft and all of these immersive games where what you see on the screen is photorealistic, and your acceptance of their reality is there, that you physically react to the environment that you're in, even though it's just a lot of pixels. But what your choices are now making changes to the game. Whereas before, you know, you shoot some ladders and life and Monopoly, you go around the track, you follow the rules. The game begins and plays and ends the same way. But there are now video games that even if you're not in an environment like Warcraft, which is fluid and open, the game will change based on the story that you want to tell. For example, The Walking Dead, which is very popular. There are some shoot 'em up games, but Telltale Games has produced three seasons of this fantastic story that could be completely different at the end, in your case, than somebody else. And it's contained into a limited narrative. So it begins to tell the story in chapter one. You get to know the characters. It's fully scripted. The characters talk to each other, and you have an opportunity to interact in one way or another with each character, and your interactions determine whether or not that character will support you an episode down the road, or they'll abandon you, you know, and your choice to sacrifice someone or to save them can mean that the game is completely different. So Janet Murray's idea is that eventually we will be able to step out onto a field or into a room, and the room will detect what we want to play, the genre, the story that you want it to hear, and it will cater to you. It will become a holodeck, essentially. And you're starting to see those three-dimensional, four-dimensional, really, those images starting to appear in VR and enhanced reality. in rooms where video monitors project three-dimensional images and holograms, and the technology is getting to the point where you can walk into a room and experience a video game all around you, which is, I think, is really fascinating.
Mm-hmm. If you're listening live and want to talk with us here, I'm here with author Jay Smith and our friend Will R. Hurl. Will R. Hurl, did I get that correct, Will?
It's William R. Hurl, but that's okay. All my friends call me
William
Will.
R. Hurl. Will, okay.
I don't mean to. I don't mean to step all over Jay's interview here. I just called in because he invited us to come down and pimp our books. So.
Oh, don't
so
worry about
book,
it, because you know I've got. Hey, sweetie, I've got a got a mute button. Don't worry about it. But you should come here. But you should come on here specifically to pimp your books. Okay, I'd be happy to have you as a special guest.
I would be happy to come on as a guest. I've been my books, and maybe by that time there's a new movie in the works, and I'm hoping to be able to talk about it sometime in the near future. So,
that'd be awesome.
Really? Oh, good. Good, good, good. Hey, that's Jay. Keep
yes.
rolling with us now.
I'm going with you? Where?
Keep
what?
Us rolling. Where
keep
did
you
we leave? I got side. The number 646-716-9922. My point, and I did have one, is to call in 646-716-9922, toll-free call in the continental U.S. We certainly like to have you call in and talk to Jay Smith. And call in now. So where did you leave off before I interrupted you with my ramble?
I don't think you did. I think I finished my ramble and cued yours, and then we kind of segued into Will Hurlsville and then came back here. So we'll get a good jump point.
William.
I'll just say that I enjoy. Go ahead. Pitch away.
No, please go ahead. Because I'm putting this out on Twitter as we go along. I'm putting things on Twitter that we're talking about. So.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'm really proud of the book and the series and the characters involved. As I was going along, I had a lot of exposure to people who really value these games as a way of getting through their lives. And the book while it includes cult behavior, it's the negative aspect of gaming. And I don't want to imply that the people that I met or all people who play these games are susceptible. Well, they might be susceptible, but are part of a cult. I talk to people who, there's an author, and Will correct me if I get this, John Gorman of Gore.
John Norman. Gore. Yes.
Yes.
A man who hated his mother.
Among other things. There is a presence on Second Life that I encounter. I don't know if it's still there. If it's grown or if it's evaporated, but it's a group that's dedicated to the principles of the author and his world. And his world is has been criticized for being misogynistic, perpetuating patriarchal, toxic masculinity attitudes, where women are subservient or they're enslaved, but their slavery is masked in considering women sacred or treating them with respect, and to do so is to make them subservient to you. Very similar to the DOS in Nexium. And I might be misrepresenting Norman's views, but I think I can fairly say that the people online also probably misrepresent his views, because they are virtual rapists, and they perpetuate a very dangerous stereotype. But this organization, this group of people, I wouldn't call it an organization, it's more of a social group. They have a pecking order. They've got rights and traditions that they uphold. And it was very unnerving to be among them for more than a couple of days. And the interviews that I conducted with people who assert that they were women, and I only spoke to them in character, admitted that they come into the world in order to be to feel as though they're part of something bigger. And the women have, whether they are really women or not, is irrelevant, because they subscribe to this ideal that they can find fulfillment only by being enslaved or by being controlled by someone else. And to a degree that's healthy, but in a society that says, you know, punishment is not, there's no consent involved. There's no free will. That's dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
John Norman's Gore series was written mainly for a readership of teenage boys, and it popularized. I don't mean that facetious. I mean, really, it was meant for teenage boys. And the society of which he writes is a society where mankind is enslaved on an alternate Earth. That's just on the other side of the sun, so you can never see it. Mankind itself is enslaved to alien creatures, and the alien creatures keep mankind enslaved by perpetuating a society where only the strongest survive. And because of this, because women in John Norman's books, because women are naturally physically less powerful than men, easily overborn, they become supportive to men only, and men fight over them. And only the most beautiful women succeed in that manner, and only the most powerful men succeed in that manner. And so they, in Norman's view, they have a perfect society. And that's how you want to look at it is how you want to look at it. I see it as a fiction, and a pleasant fiction, written by somebody who really, 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 really had bad body training.
as it's applied in virtual worlds, like most philosophies or religions or ideas, they can be corrupted. And I think when you don't have to put a whole lot of effort into making out of it what you want. And if that's simply to exploit the power aspects of that relationship, because I have a hard time believing that the attraction on Second Life is the storyline of Gore. There's very little talk about the mythology or the story. I was first introduced to that by going to a slave auction. And the conversation that I had there with people was... It was disturbing, and but they, you know, they were very matter of fact about it. They weren't like mustache twirling villains. They were just very much of a collective mindset that, you know, women are this, and this is how we treat them, and this in this world, this is our law, and this is how we do things. I'm like, okay, that's fine. There's no consequence in the real world. It's
you're saying you went to a slave auction.
Yes. I went to a couple of different ones in different worlds where characters would there's a culture of digital prostitution in Second Life, and there's always been. It was a very lucrative thing when Second Life was more popular, but you could actually create a character and make money as a prostitute by collecting what's called lindens in their currency from other users and then cashing it out.
Uh-huh.
Or you get in world to develop your empire, and there are people who make money as slaves too, or they just do it for fun.
Mm-hmm.
And there are animations and tools and just artifacts that have been built by users of Second Life and other games that that bind an avatar to another avatar, where your avatar basically does whatever it's told. It's not foolproof. I mean, you could obviously log out. But that's a part of that game. And there's BDSM elements. There's elements of consensual activities which are different in my view, where I guess there is consent where you're playing the game. The question is where is consent implied and where is it explicit? I don't know. And a lot of people, I guess the positive end of this was the people who are participating largely are consenting. There are a number of women who came out as men and who do this to fuel the engine of Gore or whatever world they're in. So it's interesting to see how virtual reality can bring out our base or interests and instincts where there are no consequences.
Mm-hmm. And when I and I'm sorry if I missed the point. Slave auction was on.
What's that? I missed you.
I attended a. Pardon?
You cut out there. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Okay. Several, can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay. So, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 years ago, I went to a meeting because the speaker was going to be, or their special guest was going to be Dolores French, and who was a very well-known at the time, very well-known prostitute and resident of Atlanta. And in fact, she headed up the group Coyote, Call Off Your Tired Old Ethics, for legalization. Ended up marrying her ACLU lawyer. But she was there to sign her book. And so I wanted to meet her. You know, I'm an armchair sociologist. Well, no, I've been to college, so now I'm an armchair ethnographer. And so, you know, I wanted to meet Dolores. And, of course, I've seen her on TV a lot. I wanted to talk, you know, talk to her, so I got her book. And while I was there, I think it was a meeting. I cannot remember the name or the type of group that was called itself. I wouldn't give away the name for anything for people's privacy. But it was, I think, a BDSM group. And somebody passed me, a guy there passed me a note, you know, saying that he wanted to be my slave, and then he spelled out something about your slave, you know, down the side of the page, and each sentence started with the word, you know, with that letter, S-L-A-V-E, and what he would do for me as my slave. Hmm. And, you know, I wasn't expecting that, and I thought, okay, how do I act? I don't want to, you know, I don't want somebody, I don't need a slave, but at the same time, you know, I wanted to show respect because I was there on his turf, you know. I was in their meeting, so I wanted to be respectful and courteous. Then again, if I was courteous back, that wouldn't really help him. But so when you mentioned that, I think, you know, Second Life, yeah, I guess everything. They're everything. There. And William R. Herb, pick up for me anywhere
yes,
you
ma'am.
Like, because I think I kind of lost my own thread there, if you don't mind.
No, that's okay.
I think it's just a shock
Jay.
Of realizing, hey, William, it's a shock of realizing I've just admitted here that I've been to a BDSM meeting, so I think that kind of, you know, threw my groove there. So please, help me out.
No, that's quite all right. Actually, that's nothing to be ashamed of. I actually, my new book, 530 Return, which will be on sale in August, not that I'm pimping it on your show, Jay, my new book, 530 Return, actually touches on the dangers when it's about addiction and corruption and how the two feed off of each other, but it also touches on the dangers of introducing drugs, recreational drug use into the BDSM community. Beyond this, slavery exists. I mean, we just have to accept slavery exists.
Yep.
There are some people who want that relationship. And who are we to say, no, you cannot have that relationship if they want to be enslaved or if they want to be slave owners? Okay. But as long as it is consensual, as long as somebody is not being ripped out and placed in under the control of someone without their consent, There is a subset of society which desperately wants to be controlled, and we see that every day. Now, the thing is that there is also non-consensual slavery, BDSM that becomes all too real. And to see that, you need go no further than Oman or now Libya. Libya is now a site of one of the two large slave auction sites in the United States. I'm sorry, in the world. And, I mean... Up until the moment that slavery was eradicated, was illegalized, I should say, in the United States, one of the largest slave auctions in the world was in Washington, D.C. So, I mean, it is something that exists, and to pretend that it doesn't exist, to pretend that that we can just laugh and sneer at it a little bit and say, well, that's from a bygone age. We're all just fooling ourselves that evil exists, hurt exists, and we're all standing on the backs of people who have miserable lives.
Absolutely.
Like nothing is new. Yeah, nothing we've done is new, and nothing is in the past that you can't. There's nothing that you know doesn't still exist somewhere. And then, like I said, one more time, if you want to talk to Jay Smith, author of The Resurrection Pact, Rise of the Monkey Lord, Seven Till Sunrise, and a lot of other good books, call us 646-716-9922. Guys, if you could scoot over just a little bit and open the beaded curtains once again. We have a guest coming in. Wait, just a minute. This is going to be... All right, come on in, tall, dark, and steampunky.
Needs to be open a little wider. I'm a big guy.
I'm sorry.
What
here,
now?
Let me move aside for you a little bit.
The curtain needs to be open a little wider. I'm a big guy.
What did
Hello?
You put in these cushions? What the hell?
Hey, guys.
It's your favorite Polish cartoonist.
Yeah, he's a cartoonist, animator, author, and... a gamer, and actually I was talking about you earlier, but you didn't know it, Peter, and
delighted
to have you here. Okay, all right. And also we're here not just with Jay Smith, but also with William R. Herr.
Well, I'm glad everybody's together, because I've kind of got a bit of a question I wanted to drop into the middle of you all for the for a discussion here. And because what caught my ear was the discussion about things like the Gore books and stuff like that and how people build these fantasy lives. I'm wondering, where do you separate things like the virtual worlds of Second Life and stuff like that? Because I'm sure you've heard the saying that if it exists, there's porn of it on the internet. There's people who write slash stories for Harry Potter. They'll do them with their characters. They'll do them with self-inserts and stuff like that. How much of what you're seeing do you think is the result of people not really I guess the best way to describe it is they haven't had sex yet, but they've heard really good things about it. And they haven't learned properly that and they haven't learned that there's things you don't do, there's considerations, you know, what do you do if the person is an abusive piece of trash and so on. How much of this do you see as normal human psychology, and how much do you see as basically the result of arrested development or just an uninformed populace just playing with their sexuality without understanding what makes it tick?
I think it's a complex answer. There are a lot of people who – I think you're right. I interviewed some people who clearly were not guided through to maturity in terms of their sexual identity or what is right and wrong in terms of consent. I grew up in the 80s. And if you watch teen sex comedies in the 80s and you decided that that was an appropriate way to deal with women, at some point you became on the wrong side of history. Fortunately for us, most of us learned to evolve. But there are people out there who I think they either they still feel a certain way, and they go to places in order to feel as though that what they think is appropriate. I think that there's a playground for adolescents out there. I mean, video games are designed for escape and, you know, and for amusement. So there's a group of people out there who just want to explore and see what feels good. A number of people in Second Life and these other games go out there to try on a different identity to see if what they want to be is socially acceptable in certain situations. And some people, as Will talked about, there are people who are submissive in nature and who want to be controlled. And a lot of them are controlling in their real lives, and they want to escape to a world where they don't have to have that that choice.
I'm sorry. A good example of that would be the Twilight series. I mean, the much maligned yet amazingly best-selling Twilight series is all about a girl who is being controlled and only wants a boyfriend.
Well, it's not just that she's being controlled. She's also just – she has completely subjugated herself. One of the funniest pictures I ever saw was a person at Barnes & Noble who took a picture, a sign that said, you know, if you've read Twilight, read this book next, and it's a book on overcoming codependency.
But, I mean, we can laugh about it, but there are people who absolutely adore the Twilight books, and they're well-adjusted, nice, women. I know one, for example, who's just, she just loves the Twilight series, and she's a professional nurse, and she's damn good at her job, and she'll bring the hurt down on you if you don't do exactly what she says, but she loves the Twilight books.
Yes, there are people that, I mean, I have my odd things that I enjoy and stuff like that. I mean, for crying out loud, I'm a 47-year-old man, and I draw a comic book with mermaids. Give me a break. But I've also seen... But I've also seen the flip side. Like, I used to have an online friend who, she was so enthralled with Edward from the book. This is no kidding, because when she sent me the picture, I couldn't believe it. She had a life-size standee of Edward that she put next to her window so that the standee could watch her while she slept, like in the book. And I saw that. I'm like, that's not healthy. The scene in the book alone isn't romantic. It's creepy. And now that you're actually reenacting it, you might need a little help.
Can I break that down for a second?
We'll grow out of that.
Can I break that down for a second?
Sure.
Okay. Let's take that suggestion right there. I always take the devil's advocate side of things. So let's take that situation just for a second. She has read about something, become enamored of it, and decided to implement it in her life as a bit of her fantasy, as she takes steps towards making it a reality. How is that different than being an author?
Well, in my mind, the difference is like, okay, let's take this for example, because I've heard about a guy online who has this. He has his bedroom styled like the Starship Enterprise, one of the decks, or I guess the bridge or something. Wasn't that big in Star Trek. But the key thing is that, you know, with that, it's like, okay, not what I would do with my money, but then again, I'd probably do something offbeat. You gave me a chance, I'd probably turn my room into the Batcave. But those things, that's a sci-fi universe. This is specifically reenacting a part of the book that does not speak well psychologically. It would be one thing if it's just, styling the house like something from The Adventure, but reenacting a scene that suggests obsession and psychological trauma, that's the part where I start to, feel the chills.
It is interesting to talk about it in this way, that a lot of these girls will grow out of it. And what I see is, and I have a stepdaughter of my own, and watching her grow up.
Really quick, I hate to interrupt. She was 25.
What's that?
I hate to interrupt, but she was 25. You know, kids do goofy things. I can understand that. But this is a 25-year-old woman, and it's like this. This is not exactly something I would recommend.
Well, then that's her choice. I mean, she's an adult, so
right.
I mean, there are going to be people who have unusual choices. I mean, does this translate to her real life? Is she involved in real relationships that are harmful?
In the time that I knew her, she wasn't really involved in any relationships. She'd had, let's be polite and say some really bad experiences. And I got the impression it was more like she'd kind of withdrawn from socializing just as a protective measure or something. And that's the reason why it's like a lot of her interests seem to reflect men that either were singular-minded and, you know, you could count on them to behave a certain way or would never hurt her. So I'm thinking it's more of a psychological projection of her own trauma from the past.
Well, if I could bring in another example, and again, I'm not suggesting that anything is good or bad or otherwise. Okay, I'm just taking a devil's advocate approach because I like to hear things from all sides. To bring in another example, I have a very good friend named Jewel. And Jewel, if you're listening, I'm not going to say anything bad about you. Jewel. Became enamored of the traveler lifestyle. Are you familiar with that? The traveler lifestyle, train hopping, living on the street.
Kind of a gypsy hobo kind of thing.
They call themselves the travelers or hobos. However, she became enamored of this lifestyle, and she was working as a waitress, not getting ahead in life. And the more she thought about it, the more she just loved the idea of just getting the hell away and not having any responsibilities at all. And so what if I'm poor? So what if I have nothing? And you and I would likely look at that and what inevitably happens, which is abuse of alcohol, abuse of drugs, being attacked, being robbed. Whole nine yards. We would say, this is not a healthy obsession. Well, she followed that obsession, and her parents supported her in it, and they said, okay, we're going to buy you some stuff to help you be safe, so you've at least got a tent to sleep in and things like that, and then do what you're going to do because you're an adult and we can't stop you, but, you know, we want you to be happy. And she went out, and she got married on the road, and she got abused by drunks, and she got away from them, and now she's lived out that portion of her life, and she's grown through it. I would say, hey, you know what? I don't agree with that, and certainly I didn't agree with it when my son said that he wanted to do it, and so I put him on the phone with her, and I said, hey, tell him what it's really like, okay? But and he changed his mind really quick, but at the same time, who am I to say that this is wrong? Who am I to say this is wrong? Who am I to say that dressing like a woman when you're actually a man is wrong? It might be an unhealthy obsession. It might be just a healthy expression. I'm not the one who can say that. And that's why I try to take the devil's advocate approach on subjects such as these, because if we can't see the other side of these issues, which may very well be psychological issues, then we can't see how it might not be a psychological issue, and it might just be something that someone needs to work through for their own path in life.
But what I'm hearing is that at the end of this journey, the lesson learned was it's not a good thing to do. And as a parent, intervened with your son.
I didn't intervene with my son. I gave him full information. And I gave him full information.
Did you actively intervene to put him in touch with somebody who had a negative view on it? And that's what a parent does. I mean, ultimately, he made his own decision.
I understand what you're saying. I would say that she didn't really. Whoop. Oh, yeah, I'm still here. I'm sorry.
Okay,
it sounded like I dropped.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. I understand what you're saying, and I understand the distinction that you're making. I would say that she's still a traveler, and she's decided, you know, to do it on her terms rather than as a all the time sort of thing. And she told my son exactly what it's like and told him, listen, you're not going to get out of this without having a criminal record. There's just no way. And my son had decided that he'd rather run a business than be poor. And that's what he does now. So, I mean, I don't see it as a good or a bad thing. And my son inevitably did get away from the family, get away from his mom and dad, out from under our thumb, and did his own thing. I'm saying that just because we don't agree with it, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing. But, yes, you're right. I did intervene in that. I brought in some reality to talk to my son so that he would know at least what he was getting into.
And I think the idea – I'm sorry, go ahead, Per.
No, go ahead and finish with that because then we're going to have to end the show.
Okay. Well, I think there's a difference.
Go ahead.
You're actively into a relationship with a lifestyle that is going to have consequences versus a fantasy. I think as long as the individual has the ability, the power to distinguish what is constructive and what is destructive, and sometimes that's the biggest gray line, and that's what makes us susceptible to cult behavior or being lured into a system where you voluntarily or involuntarily surrender your free will to someone in order to collect whatever it is you think you're missing in life.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings us back to the whole point of Resurrection Pact and the Cult of Eternus.
All right, and I'm going to have to stop. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and that's where we're going to the Cult of Eternus and Resurrection Pact by my guest, Jay Smith. And I've been so glad to have William R. Hur and my friend Peter G., who also writes for Bleeding Cool, if you read that. Glad to have you guys here. Hope you'll be back very soon. Smith,
real
quick. I have a few more things to say before we leave. Real quick.
I'm sorry, what?
Real quick. sorry. Real quick, Jay, how can we join the cult of Jay?
jsmithaudio.com.
That's what I was going to.
Yeah,
jsmithaudio.com?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I want to get to his, let me just list some stuff again. And thank you, Will. That's a very important thing we got to do. Before we go, let me say, too, if you need to have your books, you know, people can't buy your books until they know about them. And if you can't afford a publicist, get my book, sell your books today. Right now it's 99 cents on Smashwords. Yes, I am a professional entertainment publicist. 99 cents. I'll teach you some secrets from the trade. Also, hey, guys, guess what I'm doing Thursday night?
What?
What?
Okay, I've already told you one thing I've ever told people, but this Thursday night I've got an overnight shoot working on a Haunting of Hill House.
Ooh.
Nice.
And it's a funeral business convention, so I'm pretty psyched about that. Last week I worked on a faux documentary, and so this is Haunting of Hill House. Very excited about that. But anyway, I guess
I'm sorry.
I'm
psyched about going to a funeral convention.
Are you going to get EVPs? Are you going to get EVPs?
Oh, I don't know.
It's using static to get ghost voices.
I'm sorry?
It's using static to get ghost voices.
Sorry about that. My dog barked
serious,
in the background.
I thought it was a cockfight. Okay. Well, anyway, this is supposed to be a very serious theme, not spooky. And I haven't learned how to throw my voice yet. But Jay Smith, I think he coined the term geek noir. So check him out for HG World. Check out his books. I'm going to read off the titles. Diary of Jill Woodbine, Hidden Harbor Mysteries, The Resurrection Pact. Jay Smith has his spine of his book painted on the outside of a bookstore wall. Harlan Ellison said, from what I've read of Jay Smith, he's either a great scam man liar or a born writer. And William R. Herr, author, says Jay has written a book. This is talking about Diary of Jill Woodbine. Jay has written a book which takes the reader through an emotional slugfest and leaves them ready for more. So check him out, Hidden Harbor Mysteries, Resurrection Pack, 7 Before Sunrise. Jay, I'm so proud of you. And if they didn't love you enough, Jay Smith, you did one more thing that I found that a few weeks ago that just made me love you even more. The playlist on jsmithaudio.com has Stranger in a Strange Land by Leon Russell. So, folks, get to Jay Smith Audio and get his books. And remember, I'm Madam Perry. I love you. And everybody's got to swing. Good night, Jay.